One of the great joys of history is the frequent discovery of extraordinary individuals, whose passage reminds us that it is personal action as much as impersonal forces that shape our collective destinies. These discoveries are especially compelling when the actor does something unprecedented, and in the process illuminates an important but rarely told story. Such a person was Natalia Shalikova, whose late 18th-century exploits as a businesswoman highlight Russia's pioneering surge into North America. My guests today are Alexander Petrov, research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Dawn Leah Black, independent historiographer and communications specialist. Welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you for inviting.
Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure indeed. And we're going to introduce the listeners to an extraordinary woman who I think they'll want to know more about. And this, of course, is this marvelous woman, Natalia Shalikova, that we're going to meet and primarily talk about. But we have to talk about her in the context of her marriage to Grigory Shalikov, if I pronounce it correctly. He's a trader and explorer. Now, he, of course, is committed to the North Pacific territories and to activity there. But let me ask you this, Dawn. First, because I think this is really the fundamental point of this whole story. For him to be a trader and explorer is marvelous in itself, but this marriage was very much a partnership, wasn't it?
Yes. Originally, Natalia was very young when she was married. 14, is that
yes.
correct? So it started off with her basically as a child bride. It wasn't truly a partnership on the mercantile level until later. It became more of a partnership when Grigory had to go to the coast all the time and make sure that the furs got off the boats correctly and that the provisions got sent over to Alaska correctly. He was very involved over in this little town called Okhotsk. And Natalia had to stay behind in Irkutsk because they had many children. But not only did she have many children, fortunately also many servants to take care of the many children, but she was very involved with distributing the goods.
Right.
Because Grigory had to have someone he could rely on. Mm-hmm. The other merchants were cutthroat. Mm-hmm. They wanted his hide, literally. Yeah. And maybe they got it later, we're not sure, because mm-hmm. Grigory died somewhat mysteriously. But Natalia was in charge of distribution, and he grew to trust her. In their early relationship, there might have been, you know, a few misunderstandings here and there, which is understandable in a marriage. But by the time Grigory died, from their final letters, which we are publishing with commentary and an introduction, Natalia seemed to be a full partner and very involved and happy in the business, more as happy as she could
be. This is an excellent point. I mean, first of all, we're talking about a woman who, out of necessity, revealed her traits as an excellent businesswoman. And I think you point out the confidence her husband put in her. She was of absolute trust. And we're going to talk in a few moments about those letters, because the letters did portray a relationship that, quite frankly, in addition to a very strong business partnership, was very much a love match, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
In 1795, Alexander, they take a voyage together, do they not, to the Pacific territories we're talking about?
They just went, actually, to the North Pacific together. Mm-hmm. Actually, Natalia Shalikova agreed herself going with her husband, not because he forced her to go, but she decided to go herself. Mm-hmm. That's very important. And that's happened 1784 up to 1786. So they spent more than 2 years in a distant, almost unknown land, because Grigory and Natalia Shalikova founded the first Russian permanent settlement in the North Pacific.
If, you know, if the story were only that, it would be extraordinary, wouldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And that, for example, Dawn Leah mentioned that she was the partner of Grigory Shalikov, which was unusual
mm-hmm.
at that time. Because in Russia, I mean, in many countries in the world as well, being a historian, I studied, the women at that time are supposed to take care of their children.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main idea. But Natalia very much involved in business affairs, which is very much unusual.
Yeah.
I mean, even before they went to Kodiak, but after they returned from the North Pacific when they established the first permanent settlement. That's why we can call her as the founder of the first permanent settlement together with Grigory Shelikhov.
This, I think, is a very important point. She was the founder of the first permanent settlement. I mean, if you have to put one line in history, that it would seem to me to be one of the lines. I think it's time we should bring both your judgments as to her personality, because as I sit and listen to this, I think anyone listening would say, look, even if this happened in 2001, it would be extraordinary for a couple to go into such adverse circumstances and remain there for such a long period of time. And of course, Grigory would have to make long trips and she would be there alone handling all of this.
Yeah.
Look, if it's remarkable now, it is fantastic that it would happen at the end of the 18th century. So what was this woman like? Let me ask each of you very briefly what you think her personality traits that made her so unusual in her day.
Natalia was, you could almost say, a woman that was somewhat driven by her desire to accomplish perhaps what her grandfather had not accomplished as totally as she could accomplish it. At this point in time, we believe that Natalia is descended from another very early pioneer who explored Alaska, Nikifor Trepeznikov. Natalia, it seems, had a driving force that was very, very strong. Every time someone would try to cut her out of the business, she would come back even stronger. I'm serious. I mean, but not only that, you have to understand that Catherine the Great was the Tsarina at this time. She was a woman. She, as I told Alex earlier today, she, that is Catherine the Great, would scarcely give Grigory the time of day.
Yes.
She gave him a sword to award his efforts. But when it came to Natalia, when Natalia started petitioning her and then later Catherine's son through their very important son-in-law, I might add also, Razanov, Natalia got what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if there's one thing you can say about Natalia is she got what she wanted and she knew how to get it and she was very determined.
She sounds extremely determined. That is the word. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Alexandra?
Well, I thought that actually Don Lim what mentioned what it's very important that the what we had the charter of the Russian American Company, so we also can consider her as the founder of the Russian American Company, which was founded in 1799
by Paul the First.
Yes, and we just examined one of her petitions and compare with the charter, and it's almost the charter copied the her previous ideas of the establishment of the Russian American Company. So all these governmental institutions simply copied Natalia's ideas. So, I mean, it's extraordinary, mm-hmm. in my opinion. So he got the idea how to develop not only merchant trade, but also suggest what Russia should do in the North Pacific, how Russia should act with other states, I mean, on international level.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, she has to, she's supposed to have some kind of absolutely, I would say, marvelous understanding not only in domestic affairs, but also on international affairs. But in this way, she was also had very open and sincere heart. We're amazed with her letters, how she wrote, "My dear and lovely friend."
Yes, you know,
it's extraordinary. I mean, it's like, well, business plus together with her sincere and open heart.
Well, let me add to that, because you two have studied these letters. You live with these letters. I read them for the first time, a few of them in translation, of course. So, and it's interesting because my own personal reaction is exactly that, because you have two, to me, strong components. You have this hard-headed, by that I mean smart, tough businesswoman who can handle her affairs and, as you point out, really establish the model for the Russian American Company. But also, there's a tender, loving quality in these letters that's very romantic, quite frankly, toward her husband and also toward her children. There's a lot of that concern. That leads me to my next question, because the personality of Grigory Shelikhov is much different and somewhat controversial. He, for example, petitioned the Tsarina, did he not, for exclusive rights in Alaska, and I don't think the Tsarina liked him very much. I see. Well, I'm getting the sense that she didn't care.
She did not. Yeah, she did not realize.
What was so controversial about this man? And you earlier, Don, you suggested he might have even died in unclear circumstances. What led to that?
Well,
I'll say something, and he can add to it. Gregory was somewhat of a combative individual. I understand he beat up at least one of the Tsarina's emissaries, which, of course, didn't make her happy with him. But Gregory was also a very successful individual, which got him a lot of enemies because he was dealing with a very lucrative trade. And a lot of people wanted in on the action. They were willing to kill to get in on the action. And it's likely that someone finally did kill Gregory somehow. Who exactly? We're not sure. He died of possibly poisoning from some terrible stomach complaint when he had never been sick in his life. And this was a man who, you know, crossed Siberia by dog sled in midwinter and lived under the snow in little dugouts he dug for himself. I mean, he was a very strong and determined man, and he'd never been sick. And finally, you know, just all of a sudden, he decided to spend one winter in Irkutsk getting his business affairs all sorted out. It was then that somebody had access to him long enough to possibly poison him. But Gregory was, you know, Natalia even mentions in her letters about their servants, for instance, and even about their early relationship, that it seemed to have been a somewhat possibly physically abusive relationship. That, and in her letter, she says to him, well, servant so-and-so will have to be taught in your ways. Mm. And when I asked Alex what that meant, he said it meant that Gregory was going to beat him. So Gregory was, but men in those days did that. I mean, it was understood that that was okay for a man to behave in that way in those days. It wasn't so frowned upon, except if it was the Tsarina's emissary, that got him in a little bit of trouble. In addition, Gregory tended to exaggerate his exploits, which got him in even more trouble because, you know, he would tell people, oh, you know, I took 1,000 captives on Kodiak and he killed a few of them after he captured them. Of course, he's not popular in Kodiak today because he changed history in Kodiak forever. The natives don't like that. They like their original culture. They wish they still had it.
It's not fair, yes. It's not fair, right?
Yeah, but Gregory is very unpopular in Kodiak today because of the fact that basically he just shot off a few cannon. I mean, but it scared the natives very much. They stampeded. They jumped over cliffs. And apparently several of them died, although how many is controversial.
And let me just mention one thing. We have to put a distinct difference between different types of colonization. Russian colonization is different because Russians didn't have an interest to destroy natives. They wanted them to help with their fur hunting because peoples from Kodiak, from Aleutian Islands, just very good in hunting sea animals. Mm-hmm. They're interested in cooperation rather than destroying, rather than killing in many ways. Of course, I'm saying that they treated in many ways these people as barbarians, but they didn't necessarily mean that they got to kill them. That's very important.
Well, what you're telling us is they came with no policy of extermination or anything like
that's
that.
That's right.
Of course, as Don has pointed out, though, there was some cultural conflict necessarily that is still somewhat in memory. But I think the points both of you are making is that the Shelikovs together and Natalia brilliantly represent many things. I mean, not just a major political opening, so to speak, but also trade and mercantile relations. And then in the character of these expeditions, we get a religious influence also coming into the territory. So it's quite a complete story. Let me take a moment from our story just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guests today are Alexander Petrov, a research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Dawn Leah Black, independent historiographer and communication specialist. Alex, let me ask you this. A minute ago, we mentioned the probably almost non-existent or certainly very difficult and troubled relationship between Grigory and the Tsarina. Mm-hmm. What was Natalia's relationship with her like?
You see, if we're speaking about difficult relations between, let me just mention, maybe also Don Lee will help me with this question, because let me first mention the difficult relations between Gregory and Tsarina. It was not really difficult, I would say, because when Gregory returned from establishing permanent settlement in Alaska, he presented a detailed report to Tsarina asking for monopoly. for one particular company. For
this
his
I mean,
company.
It's Catherine, by the way.
Yeah, Catherine the Great. Catherine the Great. And that's happened, that's the time frame, that's 1787. And you know, at that time, Catherine was very much involved in her relations on the Black Sea, specifically war with Turkey. So that's the idea. So she paid less attention to the unknown territories. Just imagine, Siberia at that time was almost even Siberia unknown land. Just on the time frame, it took more than 1 year for a letter to be delivered from St. Petersburg to Kodiak. 1 year. And 1 year back. It's different time frame. So when Grigory Shelikhov came and presented her to Catherine the Great everything that she got, Tsarina was very skeptical and put a lot of humor on that. And she told, well, it's almost impossible to get from these expeditions like to teach the elephant to speak. You know, she was very skeptical, but she liked the idea of such the merchants who would like to establish some kind of a colony that would be a Russian empire,
right,
to show how great is Russian empire. And that's why she granted Grigory Shelikhov a sword and a medal, and plus his partner Golikov as well. So, and she was very skeptical because of the monopoly. She believed in laissez-faire.
Mm-hmm. She wanted competition.
Yeah, she wanted competition. That's the Natalia at that time when Grigory came to St. Petersburg, she was in Irkutsk, took care of her husband's business. And in my understanding that after this age, 1787, she became a full-scale partner of her husband. And all letters reveal that she was very much involved in this business. And that's only because of her, that's the company actually formed, that's what
right.
I mentioned.
But in developing this business, and I think you explained very well about the nature of Catherine the Great's doubts, if you will, about
yes.
what's going to go, going to work up there. But did Natalia get what kind of relationship did Natalia get with the Tsarina? Did she petition the Tsarina at all for help?
Yes, Natalia actually petitioned Tsarina only after the death of Grigory Shelikhov. That's important, because of course, I mean, that's again family relations. Mm-hmm. We are talking about the end of the 18th century. That's the predominant role of husband over mm-hmm. wife. I mean, it was.
So what she's asking for is the right to continue her husband's business.
That's right.
I see.
That's right.
Let me ask you this, Don, as an historian and as an Alaskan, and I think this must be in the minds of people listening to you. If you think of Russia and all the might and the power of Russia, and particularly in those days with the expanse of territory coming into North America, claiming this vast territory. Riches going in the fur trade and so forth. Why did it all come to an end? I know this is a very complex story, but what would lead in 1867 to the sale?
Well, that's something historians still dispute today, you know, just what exactly happened. And there is an article specifically on that topic that people can read. I think the Wilson Center has actually published it, you know, The End of Russian America or something like that in one of their books. For one thing, there were some financial problems, but they weren't enormous. I did read this article. Actually, even though the sea otter trade petered out, they were making money by doing other things, mm-hmm. you know, selling things with the Yankees and even though the sea otter wasn't so important, there were, you know, they were still making money by various other means, selling things even to their own colonies. They made vast amounts of money that way because they were overcharging their own people. Okay.
That's one way to make money.
Yeah, it made them sort of unpopular, but they made money at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't losing money when they sold Alaska. It wasn't that they were so poor they had to go out of business. I think the main conclusion of the article that I read, that Wilson Center, I believe, published, mm-hmm. was that it became politically expedient because of the wars they were involved in elsewhere, and their attentions mainly turned to other places.
Right.
and it wasn't so convenient for them to keep Alaska going. Mm-hmm. And they were under pressure from the Americans. They were under pressure from the British. And even the British and the Americans and the Indians did attack together the Russians at times.
So it got to be, in a sense, too much trouble.
Too much trouble.
Yeah.
Let me just add a few lines. If you're speaking about the sale of Alaska, it's important to mention that the idea of the sale of Alaska initiated by the Grand Duke of Constantine. He was the head of Navy Ministry of the Russian Empire. And that was the time of the Crimean War. And Russia actually lost in this war. And it showed how weak a Russian fleet was at that time. And it's also shown, that's according to Constantine, that Russia got very difficult position and had to protect their far distant colonies. And the profit was not at that time as huge as it was expected. And that's the main idea. But unfortunately, when the whole decision made, I mean, that happened actually with the Fort Ross. When the Fort Ross sold, found gold, same thing happened.
That's right, Sutter's Mill.
Yes,
Sutter's Mill.
The same thing happened.
Exactly.
And everyone read Jack London and the so-called Golden Rush. That's why some of the, you know, even now, Russians, not some of them, radicals, not happy with Alaska just mentioning, look, found gold. Mm-hmm. Exactly, I mean, it's bad luck. But I mean, still, that's a little bit humor, but at that time, it was real difficult for Russia to just simply to defend the colonies.
What you're telling us is really a classic story of overextension of empire, when your military forces cannot defend what you already have, and you end up giving. And then we have the law of irony, because the minute you give it away, someone finds finds gold there.
This is
also a classic story. Speaking of classic stories, and let's turn briefly to the later years of Natalia Shelikova. Because we've discussed the early years of her marriage, her powerful career as a businesswoman, the impact on history, and her succession of her husband after his death to continue. But of course, there were later years in her life. It's a long story, but briefly, what characterization would you give to them, Dawn, first, and then Alexander?
Well, she, her daughters kept marrying rich and important people like Razanov, who was very, very active in the court, sort of friendly with the new Tsar Paul and the Tsar after him,
Alexander the First.
Unfortunately, Razanov died on his way back to St. Petersburg from Alaska and California. So his influence wasn't all for that long. But Razanov helped Natalia. And basically, the other son-in-law, Buldakov, and Razanov got together. They were both rich and semi-rich and important people. Razanov wasn't so rich himself. That's mainly why he married Shelikov's daughter. But he was very influential. The other son-in-law, Buldakov, was a rich merchant from Alexander's home area up there by Veliky Ustyug and Vologda. Those two son-in-laws eventually sort of edged Natalia out. They weren't really vicious, I don't think, but the thing was that Natalia was illiterate.
This is true. This is another point. And even those letters that she dictated, did she not?
She dictated her letters, but she accomplished a great deal for an illiterate woman. But when it came to actually, you know, taking care of the day-to-day business, all the paperwork, all the petitions and all that, even though she was very involved early on and accomplished a great deal, her son-in-laws gradually took over. There's also a document which we have not acquired at this time, but it's supposedly written by the brother of Shelikov about Natalia just before she died. And the implication was that she possibly became alcoholic. So she was under a lot of pressure. You have to understand that this was an age when men ruled the world, basically, not women, except for Catherine the Great and a few other important women. But I mean, in business, it was the men. And Natalia was under a tremendous lot of pressure. There was vicious, vicious gossip about her. I think, as you said, she's a sensitive soul, a loving soul. And even in her letter, she talks about a lot about shedding buckets of tears, so to speak, over various and sundry little things. She was a sensitive woman. And being under as much pressure as she was for as long as she was, I think, might have taken a toll on her. What is marvelous is that she accomplished so much before it took the toll on her that apparently it might have.
Absolutely.
And I would like also to add that a Russian-American company was formed in 1799. As Don Lee mentioned, that one of her sons-in-law, Buldakov, was the first general director of the company. And Natalia was very active for 4 years after her husband died, 1795, up to 1799. And then it was the first Russian-American company. What's the Russian-American company? The first Russian joint stock monopolistic company. And that's the company that also the imperial family took part. So it also, I mean, in this field, everything was the first. Mm-hmm. And Natalia happened to be just only a shareholder. She was very active in forming the whole structure. But it happened to be like after 4 years, almost like nothing to do, just only wait for the profit. Mm-hmm. Her son's law working actually instead of her. So, but her personality is very active. She had to do something. And having nothing to be done, she faced some problems, I would say internal problems. She was trying to do something. But at that time, he did not find her place after that, basically speaking.
Well, that's a very good analysis of the drama of this remarkable woman's life and later years. Let me ask you this very briefly as we conclude our conversation. Every story has a moral, every story worth telling. And on stories like this, the moral is as important as the tale and the verdict and the lesson we draw from it. And while that's a vast subject in and of itself, if I were to ask you of the importance of this remarkable woman, Natalia Shalikova, for today's era, you know, why should people be concerned about her? What does she offer to the Russia of today or Russian women in business today and that kind of thing? And I would ask you to try to answer that in one sentence each. What would you say? Don first.
Well, I suppose you could say, try again and you will succeed. That's certainly what Natalia did. She was a very successful woman and a role model for her era.
Excellent.
I think that Natalia, that's the person who actually made possible to meet frontiers, Russian and American frontiers. That's the woman who united actually nations, so to speak, Russia and the United States.
Hmm. Well, those are wonderful answers. Both the perseverance and the political imagination brought together in one person. Thank you for introducing us all to Natalia Shalikova.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guests today were Alexander Petrov and Don Leah Black. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our assistant producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146.